Christina Vella joins us by phone tonight after receiving her PhD in European and U.S. history from Tulane University in New Orleans. She was a professor of history for many years. She now devotes most of her time to writing. She frequently serves as a consultant and writer for the U.S. Department of State Curatorial Division. Her books include Intimate Enemies, The Two Worlds of the Baroness de Pontalba, The Hitler Kiss, and Indecent Secrets. Tonight we'll talk about her latest book. It is titled George Washington Carver, A Life. Welcome to Around Cincinnati. I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be interviewed by you.
I think for many of us, certainly when I was a child, George Washington Carver was one of the few Black Americans who showed up in our history books. And the focus was sort of solely on peanut butter. That was his claim to fame. He was so much more than that. And you do such a remarkable job of bringing him to life. So let's begin with his very early life. Who was his mother? What horrendous experience happens when he's an infant? And who raised him?
His mother was a slave who had been purchased by his owner at the age of 13. And apparently they bought her to protect her from some situation because she was too young to really be much help on the farm. His owners were two very good, genteel, illiterate white people. When he was an infant, he and his mother were both kidnapped by raiders. This was during the Civil War, and all authority had broken down. So anybody could come along and say, oh, I'm with the Confederate Army, or I'm with the Union Army, and I'm taking over this farm. They could do whatever they wanted to because there was no police, there was no army there to restrict them. So they kidnapped George and his mother and took them to Arkansas, and his owners, he sent someone after him with a racehorse to ransom the mother and the child. Well, they never saw the mother again, and George was never able to track her down. What happened to her is a complete mystery. But the man brought George Washington Carver back with him. He was just a few weeks old, and he was suffering from exposure and malnutrition and whooping cough, so that his voice all of his life had the timbre of an aging soprano. He had this very high, strange voice from infancy. So he brought him back, and the Carvers raised him. When he was about 10, they could not teach him anything because they were illiterate, but they were very kind, and they cared about him. They wanted him to be educated. So with their permission, he was not able to attend the white school that was in his town, which was Diamond Grove, Missouri, now called Diamond, Missouri. So when he was 10, he walked the 10 miles to Neosho, where there was a school for Black kids that had been set up by the Freedmen's Bureau, and he learned to read, and from then on, he supported himself. He would work a few months, and then when he had enough money saved, he'd go to school for a few months. So he finally managed to get through high school in his mid-20s. And there were many more adventures. At one point, he walked 25 miles to a college that had accepted him. And when he got there, they had advertised open enrollment. And he got letters of recommendation and his grades together and all the things that you do when you're applying to a college. And when he got there, they said, oh, we're open for Indians. We welcome Indians, not Negroes. And that was it. That was 5 minutes. It was over. And he tried homesteading with the free land that was given by the government. But finally, after many misadventures, he managed to graduate from Iowa State University. At that time, it was Iowa State College, which at the time was the Harvard of agricultural colleges. There were men there, professors who were his professors, who later served in Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet, and they really valued Carver. He got a master's degree there. He was given a faculty appointment. He became the head of an experiment station, one of the first experiment stations there, and he had a secure, wonderful position that probably could have taken him through the rest of his life. But Booker T. Washington happened to come through Iowa and stopped to interview Carver, to invite him to come to the hills of Alabama, to this ramshackle Tuskegee Institute, and teach.
If we were to meet George Washington Carver, what would our impression be? What was he like? And what were some of his talents? Because I came away from reading this book thinking he was a Renaissance man.
Carver was, in the opinion of Albert Einstein, one of the 10 greatest scientists of his time. Now, that's quite an accolade coming from whom it comes from. He was the kindest individual I have ever met in history. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He taught himself to play any instrument he wanted. He could play half a dozen, play them well, play them to such a degree that he would accompany church services or be the resident musician for some church, because he could play anything he wanted, any instrument, any piece. He loved art and, in fact, spent 3 years, almost graduated from an art institute. And the reason he didn't was that one of his professors saw that he would have a beggarly life as a black artist and that he really needed to go into something where he could work and be appreciated. So it was she who moved him to Iowa State. Her father was the head of the botany department, and so he left this art institute, but he was a wonderful artist. And in fact, he established a museum of his paintings, which unfortunately, after his death, caught on fire and destroyed them. So we really can't judge him as an artist. But as a child, for example, he would mix flowers to get pigments and use his fingers and paint on pieces of broken glass or on trees that had been cut that had a clean face, anything he could get to paint on, because he had no painting materials or anything like that. So all of his life, he painted his own Christmas cards, he painted portraits. He was an amazing person. And as strange as it seems to those of us who grew up with Carver's name in our history books, a lot of kids nowadays don't know who he is, which just astonishes me. They don't realize that when he went to Alabama and he found that the sharecroppers were starving because the soil had been leached by cotton, he found that the one thing that could replenish the soil was peanuts. And peanuts was no more a cash crop than parsley. I mean, people couldn't imagine trying to make money out of fields of peanuts. So he had to create products that they could sell that would make a demand for peanuts. He found over 3,000 products from peanuts and sweet potatoes and other things like mud, clay, weeds, just throwaway things, barnyard feathers. He made things like linoleum, insecticide, gasoline, glue, plastics, rubber, soap, cosmetics, all kinds of cosmetics, 73 kinds of paint from the clay in Alabama. So that by the time he died, peanuts was the third most important cash crop of Alabama and Georgia. Mm. So he really did lift those people out of poverty with his own ingenuity. And believe me, he's working in a lab that's nothing like we consider a lab. I mean, an eighth grade laboratory, a grammar school laboratory probably has more equipment than he had.
Just if you could briefly describe the relationship with Booker Washington and who was Carver in that relationship?
The relationship between Carver and Booker T. Washington is one of the most fascinating things about his life. There is no question that Booker did a great deal for his people, more than a great deal. There is also no question, at least in my mind, that he was a cruel, ruthless, horrible person. And he was especially horrible to Carver. He brought him to Tuskegee. He valued him because Carver was able to get all kinds of publicity for the school through his connections in Washington. His friends had met people who had been his teachers. But he was profoundly jealous of him and did everything he could to suppress his research. He would delay printing any of his papers and bulletins for years. He'd claim, oh, we can't afford to print that, and just shove it aside. And Carver had this really pathological adoration of Booker. It was almost as if he was the demanding father that he never could satisfy. And he was always trying desperately to please him. And of course, Booker would not be pleased. By the way, I call him Booker because that is the way he liked to be called by the staff and the students, not to his face, but I mean, they had chants, we love our Booker and this sort of thing. So he was universally known as Booker. He would foster cabals against Carver. He would criticize him in captious ways. He was really just horrible to him. And the final thing was that he was largely responsible for the suicide of a woman Carver loved, began persecuting the two of them. It was a very complicated thing, but she finally threw herself off the top of Tuskegee's tallest building.
And this is Adela.
In 1915, Adela Hunt.
He also has a long relationship with her sister, and there was a particular speculation about why they did not marry, and this has to do with his physical characteristic.
He took up with her sister, Sarah, who was the whole Hunt family was really only 1/16th black. They could choose to identify with either the black race or the white race, and some of the brothers, in fact, passed for white and sort of abandoned the family. But Adela and Sarah settled there in Tuskegee and worked for what they felt was their race, the black race, and they were really wonderful, active, brilliant women. Sarah had hair that was supposed to reach down to her knees. She and Adela both looked as white as I do. Nobody would have identified them as black if they had not identified themselves. George Washington Carver was absolutely anthracite. He was so black that in pictures, you almost can't tell his features because the light, he just soaks up the light. He's so dark. But there was no question about Carver being a genius because he had mixed white blood or anything like that. He was a pure Negro. And he was, in fact, at the time that Booker recruited him, Booker preferred light-skinned people like himself. Carver was one of the blackest people. Later on, more blacks went to Tuskegee, but at the time that he went there, about 1896, he was probably the only really black man there. And the others looked down on him and treated him rather badly, the faculty did. But in any case, he took up with Sarah. Now, Carver, one of his outstanding eccentricities was that his fellow students had given him a suit to wear as a gift because they adored him at Iowa, and they gave him a microscope when he left. He wore that suit for the next 40 years. About every 10 years, it changed color, and it got more and more threadbare. But people gave him all kinds of clothes, and they were stacked up in his closet. He wore that suit and that suit exclusively. He loved being shabby. He was clean. He looked like a homeless person.
This is a man who had relationships with FDR, Henry Wallace, Gandhi, Ford. Edison actually offers him a job, and still
$100,000 a year.
Yeah, which he
and he turns it down because he wants to serve his people at $1,000 a year when they paid him. Yeah, he looked horrible, but I believe, having read so many of his letters and so much about the thing from people who were their contemporaries, I think what happened was that, first of all, they recognized that if they left Tuskegee, the two of them, she white, he black, they couldn't go anywhere without being perceived as a mixed-race couple. And this was at a time when people were being lynched right and left for just that. It was against the law, and in states, not just in the South, there were some years there were more white men lynched than black. Why? Because they had consorted with Negro women. So nationwide, there was no place where they could be really safe. That was, I think, one of their major considerations. So why couldn't they just stay at Tuskegee, where they were known, they were safe, they were secure? They couldn't, basically, because in my opinion, Sarah saw what Booker and what had happened to her sister, and she wanted more than anything else to get away from that atmosphere. Now, Booker died about the same time that her sister committed suicide, but the atmosphere there was just poisonous. She died amid, God knows, all kinds of gossip and rumor mills and all that. I mean, it was a terrible place to be for Sarah. So I think she wanted him to get away from there. He could have taught at another black institution, but I think he couldn't leave. I think it was his attachment somehow, this pathological attachment to Tuskegee, to Booker, to the memory of Booker. He gave half a year's salary toward a memorial for Booker Washington, who had treated him like dirt. I mean, it was inconceivable that he wouldn't hate him, but he didn't. He went into deep mourning over this woman who had killed herself, whom he loved, and over Booker. So I think that was the reason. Finally, she just gave up trying to get him away from there, and they parted.
One of his assistants describes him as, quotes, kindness itself. And one does come away from reading your book thinking, this is an extraordinarily altruistic man. What was George Washington Carver's motivation? What does he say he wanted to do and why he worked so long and hard?
He wanted all of his accomplishments to redound to his race. He was colorblind himself. He had white friends, black friends. He loved white people, black people. But he recognized that if he stayed at Tuskegee and he worked alone in his little laboratory, it would show people what blacks could accomplish, that they were just as capable of genius, of inventiveness, of contributions to their society, given a chance. And it's amazing to me how he succeeded, because when he died, and long before he died, he was so famous. His face was on the cover of Time, Newsweek, Look, every magazine you can name. He was on the radio every other night. He was known everywhere. There were third grade kids who didn't know who the President of the United States was, but they knew who George Washington Carver was, because there were thousands, really thousands, of books written for children about this black man. So people, even though it was a period of virulent racism, the racism of that time is nothing. I mean, like the racism now. We don't have racism compared to that racism. Negroes were treated worse than dirt. I don't think kids today can even imagine the lives that were normal in those days in the South. But they completely exempted Carver from that. Everybody knew he was a black scientist, but they loved him. They read everything about him. They listened to everything he said. They wrote to him hundreds of letters seeking his advice about raising children, about their love affairs, about raising animals, raising plants, right, about life. He was just somehow different from everyone else, and it did make people realize that they were capable of loving black people and that black people were part of this country and had their purchase on its accomplishments.
Wonderful book. He had a varied and extraordinary life, and thank you so much for giving us this in-depth portrait of this bright and altruistic person, George Washington Carver. Thanks for visiting with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking with Christina Vella about her latest book. It is titled George Washington Carver, A Life. You'll find more information at wvxu.org/AroundCincinnati. I'm Barbara Gray.